The Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
622 days, 12 hours, 49 minutes, 28 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office, assuming that there's not an impeachment or a resignation in the offing. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. When are the Democrats, when are the modern-day Democrats going to come up with a coherent policy to take back America, specifically the American economy, the American middle class, to bring back American values, to bring back morality in government? Now, just remember that phrase for a moment. When are the Democrats going to start talking about morality in government, and how can we help? Today is Harry Truman's birthday. And Harry Truman had some very specific ideas about what morality in government meant. And oddly enough, there is a front page story in today's Wall Street Journal about this and a major story in today's New York Times. And it is almost completely being ignored across the board in most of the progressive media. David Sirota writes a lot about this stuff. And in fact, he'll be on the program in the third hour of our program today, of our show, and along with Marion Wright Edelman about some of these topics. And in our second hour, by the way, coming up in our second hour, Chicago Tribune reporter Naftali Ben-David is going to tell us how great Rahm Emanuel is, how he's responsible for the Democrats winning in the 2006 election. That should be an interesting conversation. Which also brings me back to this question of when are the Democrats going to start talking like Democrats? Harry Truman, on March 29th, 1952, talking, this was an election year. This was 6 months before an election, Harry Truman talking about morality in government and the Democratic view of it, the big D Democratic view of it, that is to say the Democratic Party's view of it. Here's a little bit of Harry Truman, first of all.
Now I want to say something very important to you about this issue of morality in government. It is just as immoral to use the lawmaking power of the government to enrich the few at the expense of the many as it is to steal money from the public treasury. That is stealing money from the public treasury.
You get that? It's just as immoral to use the power of government to enrich the few. Which, I mean, now, what did George W. Bush do with the last tax cut? If you earn your living by dividend or capital gains income, you pay a maximum income tax of 15% now. All the rest of us who work for a living, we pay into the 30% range.
Legislation that favored the greed of monopoly and the treachery of Wall Street was a form of corruption that did the country four times as much harm as Teapot Dome ever did.
Now, first of all, note that he's talking about legislation that allowed monopoly. And that's what I want to get into today. And then he mentioned Teapot Dome. This was where Albert Fell, who was the Secretary of the Interior, as I recall, under Republican President Harding, for a $300,000, today it would be called a lobbying fee, gave a good friend of his, today it would be called Halliburton, the right to drill for oil, or for natural gas, actually, at Teapot Dome in Wyoming. And this nearly brought down the Republican Harding administration. Huge scandal back in the day, right? So anyhow, here's Harry Truman railing about monopoly.
Private, selfish interests are always trying to corrupt the government in this way. Powerful financial groups are always trying to get favors for themselves. Now, the Democratic administration has been fighting against these efforts to corrupt the powers of government. We haven't always won, but we have never surrendered, and we never will.
This is Jim Hal Harry. It's his birthday today.
For all these years, we've been fighting to use our natural resources for the benefit of the public.
Now, again, where are the Democrats on this?
To develop our forests and our public oil reserves and our water power for the benefit of all. To raise the incomes of all our citizens. To protect the farmer and the worker against the power of monopoly.
against the power of monopoly. There's that word again. And again, keep it in mind, because I'm going to come to that in just a minute.
And where have the Republicans been in this fight for morality in government?
Uh-oh. Now, notice how Harry Truman is framing this. It's monopoly is immoral, and this is all about morality in government.
Do they come out and vote with us to keep the special interests from robbing the public? Not at all. Most of them are on the other side. The same thing when you come to the question of the conduct of government officials. The Republicans make a great whoop and holler about the honesty of federal employees. But they are usually the first to show up in a government office asking for special favors for private interests and in raising cane if they don't get them.
Jamel, Harry. This is Harry Truman.
These Republican gentlemen can't have it both ways. They can't be for morality on Tuesday and Thursday and then be for special privileges for their clients on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Well, I don't think the black is white campaign of the Republican Party is going to succeed. I think the voters are going to see through this holier-than-thou disguise that our Republican friends are putting on. All the tricks of Republican propaganda cannot make the people forget that the Democratic Party has been working for their welfare.
And there you go. Harry Truman, today's his birthday, and it is a perfect juxtaposition for these several stories. The first from the New York Times. For our question for the day, when will Democrats come up with a coherent policy to take back America and how can we help? Because there's been so much sellout along the way on this in the Democratic Party, the so-called DLC wing, by and large, of the Democratic Party, with Bill Clinton's Telecommunications Act in 96 and with the NAFTA and CAFTA and the free trade, all these so-called free trade agreements, which are actually corporate free trade agreements, 40% of all international trade, 40% of all international trade is within companies. In other words, it is one company selling to itself from one country to another. And they simply decide to fix the price so that they can leave the profits in whichever country they're going to pay the lowest tax rate. That's not free trade. That's scamming the system. I mean, that's what's going on. So anyhow, here's the article in today's New York Times by Robin Toner. The headline, for Democrats, new challenge in age-old rift. And the focus of the story is Sandra Levin, who is the senior Democratic senator from Michigan. And Sandra Levin is a guy that I have always admired, and I still do. He's 75 years old. He's been in the Senate for a long, long time. And he says, we're building a Democratic trade policy. This spring, Mr. Levin and his committee chairman. Now, this is where I part company with Sandra Levin and with Charlie Rangel. In fact, we had Charlie Rangel on this show a while back, and this is on trade policy. And I said, you know, Charlie, this is after he talked about how much he liked the draft, and I said, okay, that's great. You know, we can have a discussion about that. And then I said, you know, Congressman Rangel, you know, for 200 years in the United States, if there was a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of shoes made in this country and somebody wanted to make that pair of shoes for 20 cents worth of labor in Mexico or 10 cents worth of labor in China, we said, that's fine. But when you bring them into this country, you're going to pay an 80-cent tariff from Mexico or a 90-cent tariff from China. So wherever you make those shoes, it's going to cost you a buck in terms of the labor. And that's why we made shoes in this country for 200 years. Why are you opposed to tariffs? And he was unwilling, frankly, to answer the question, went off into a thing about, oh, we can't, you know, we don't want to go back to Smoot Hall, we've got to have free trade, blah, blah, blah. I just strongly disagree. So anyhow, here's today's New York Times. This spring, Mr. Levin and his committee chairman, Representative Charles B. Rangel of New York, unveiled, quote, a new trade policy for America, end quote, a first effort at a grand compromise. Why do we need to compromise with the Republicans? Is it just because Democrats are getting big campaign contributions from the same people? Back to the New York Times. This grand compromise promises to use trade agreements to raise labor and environmental standards around the world, push open new markets for American goods, and use new government programs to cushion the growing insecurity of American workers. Let me translate that for you. Instead of somebody making 10 cents an hour in a sweatshop in China, they're now going to make 50 cents an hour. Instead of badly polluting China, they'll only moderately or not at all pollute China. And yet still it's going to be cheaper than made here in the United States. And in terms of softening the blow, yeah, we'll pay for you know, community college for a few people to be retrained to do what? To become better managers at McDonald's? Like, you know, as our manufacturing jobs are going overseas, the Democratic Party is completely adrift when it comes to trade policy and when it comes to this whole issue of monopoly, which is the second, again, you heard Harry Truman calling monopoly the essence of the issue of morality in government, which leads us to an article in today's Wall Street Journal, on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, which I'll tell you about right after this break. These are the issues of our day, because this is what the middle class of America is going to survive or be destroyed by. And nobody's talking about it. 16 minutes past here.
Is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-302-2270. Democrats, when's the Democratic Party going to come up with a coherent policy to take back America, and how can we help make it happen? By the way, the folks in the chat room point out to me, the subject of the article in the New York Times today was Congressman Levin, Senator Levin, as opposed to his brother, the senator. I said senator. His brother, that's Senator Carl Levin, the senator from Michigan. So I'm today's my day to stand corrected, and in fact, Rodney in Aurora, Colorado, as I was talking about Albert Fell, it's Albert Fall in the Teapot Dome scandal, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
I wanted to bring up was that from what I remember from my college history classes 20 years ago, Harding wasn't necessarily involved in that directly. It was a conspiracy between the Secretary of the Navy, who had control over Teapot Dome, that was the Naval Oil Reserve, and the Secretary of the Interior, Albert Bacon Fall. And they were going to then, Secretary of Interior was going to lease them to, you know, oil barons and split the profit.
I didn't mean to suggest that Harding was involved in it. But good point, Rodney, and thank you for setting us straight. I appreciate the call, and I appreciate you doing it. The one thing that will get you on, the two things that will get you on this program very quickly are, if I've made a mistake and you want to set it straight, just for the record, and B, if you want to disagree with me, we'll do that. Here's the story that's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal that I think is, these are the keys to the kingdom. Those, and at the risk of sounding like back in the old days, I remember when things were a bit different. At the risk of sounding like that, those of you who are old enough to remember what the United States was like before Ronald Reagan, remember that every strip mall was filled with locally owned stores. Downtown areas were, by and large, vibrant and filled with locally owned stores. That even suburban areas had locally owned, and the great homogenization of America happened starting in the mid-80s as a consequence of Reagan's stopping the enforcement of policies that had to do with, as you recall, Harry Truman talking about morality in government.
Legislation that favored the greed of monopoly and the trickery of Wall Street.
And monopoly, right? And so here we are, front page of the Wall Street Journal, the headline: as deal barriers fall, takeover bids multiply. Regulators and size pose less of a problem. Nobody is off limits. One after another, the long-standing barriers that protected companies from takeovers are dissolving. Now, keep in mind, this is the Wall Street Journal, so they're writing it from the point of view of the companies themselves, not we the people and the impact on individuals. But there's a huge impact on we as a nation, number one. And number two, there's a huge impact on individuals who want to be entrepreneurs, people who want to go out and start small businesses. That's the whole point of monopoly, is that it eliminates real competition in the marketplace. The great example is how our gasoline prices are being manipulated right now. But, you know, one of many. Telephone, you know, for example, I there is only one phone company I can get phone service from right now, you know, with copper coming into the house here in where I live, here in Portland. When I lived in Vermont, there was a small company, it's called Sovernet, that was competing with the big baby Bell, Bell Atlantic or whatever it reincarnated itself as, Verizon or whatever. And for a flat rate and very good service. And if you called, you talked to somebody who was like in the town or the next town over. I think it was based in St. Johnsbury. We were living in Montpelier. It was incredible service. And the Republicans actually introduced legislation in the Vermont House to make it illegal. You know, in other words, to hand over monopoly power to the big companies. So the Wall Street Journal talking today about how family-controlled companies, especially those with a special class of super voting stock, were once thought to be untouchable, but that hasn't stopped Rupert Murdoch's News Corp from offering $5 billion for Dow Jones, the publisher of the Wall Street Journal. See, all of a sudden the Wall Street Journal is concerned about this. But the biggest barrier, the U.S. government, now this is the kicker. Even the biggest barrier, the U.S. government, doesn't seem insurmountable. Exhibit A, Alcoa Inc., which yesterday made a $26.9 billion unsolicited offer for Canada's Alcan Inc., that deal would recreate an aluminum giant that the U.S. government spent nearly 40 years trying to break up. They go on to note Democrats in Congress have yet to change laws in ways that would make deal-making harder. Executives are often happy to do deals this way because they get big payouts that are change of control clauses in their contracts. See, it's very often not even good for the company. But the senior executives who are making this happen, they walk away with millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in many cases. And now, as the Wall Street Journal points out, the maximum tax rate on capital gains and dividends is only 15%. But in 2009, it's going to go up to 20% for capital gains and 35% dividends unless Congress acts. So right now, everybody is trying to make a deal. They go on to Howard Weisenfeld, portfolio manager, D.K.R. Ibex, merger arbitrage fund. He says, your head is constantly spinning. Every single industry is being restructured. What we're seeing, end of quote, what we're seeing now is this huge rise of monopoly. Here's a quote from the Berkeley Haas School of Business, Carl Shapiro. He says, the line has clearly shifted in favor of big mergers between competitors, deals that would have been blocked in early administrations. In fact, the number of times that the Bush Justice Department has intervened to challenge mergers in the last 3 years is the lowest in the last 20 years. And I would say that Jimmy Carter breaking up AT&T was the last time a president seriously intervened in this on behalf of we the people against these oligarchic corporations. 27 minutes past.
Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Continue to have progressive talk radio on the air, because if you do, I mean, it gets real simple. Just support us by supporting our sponsors. Listen to and for the sponsors on your local station, particularly your local sponsors on your local station, and also our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee at sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics at smalldog.com, or the Organic Wine Company at ecowine.com, or 1-888-ECOWINE. So anyhow, how do you make this thing sexy? I mean, this is the question. I'm talking about monopoly, and people go, oh, isn't it a game? Yes, it was a game invented in the 1920s so that people could, by progressives, so people could figure out what the whole robber baron thing was about. How unregulated capitalism eventually leads to a small handful of very wealthy corporations and, by proxy, very wealthy people controlling basically everything. And that is the direction that we went in after the Progressive Era that ended more or less in 1918, right up until the Republican Great Depression started in 1929, and arguably until the election of 32. And then we came back in a more progressive direction from 1932 until 1980, and now we're back 26 years into another right-wing period from 1980-81 with the installation of Ronald Reagan, the election of Reagan in 1980. Entirely as a result of the holding of the hostages in Iran. Up until today, all these conservative policies, and it has led to the destruction in large part of the American middle class. So how do you make a discussion about monopoly and all this kind of thing sexy? Well, how about this? Over at Cringely's, PBS.org, Cringely, I guess PBS's blogger, I don't know, the pulpit, it's called Lean and Mean. He says, last year he wrote a series of columns on management problems at IBM Global Services. And now he says, this the biggest restructuring of IBM since the Gerstner days is coming down the road. This week, it generated almost no press. IBM laid off 1,300 people. But he says, what's really going on is that this is a rehearsal for what I understand are another 100,000 layoffs to follow. This is called the LEAN program at IBM. Lean. And it rolled out last week with a 10-city planning for global services. He says, Lean is about offshoring and outsourcing at a rate never seen before at IBM. All of this is supposed to happen by the end of 2007, by the way, at which point IBM will also freeze its U.S. pension plan. Why? He says, the point of this has nothing to do with the work itself and everything to do with the price of IBM shares. Remove at least 100,000 heads, eliminate the long-term drag of a defined benefit pension plan, and the price of IBM shares will soar. A stock market going up does not mean a healthy economy. It means more workers out of work. It means more jobs being shipped overseas. It means more corporations doing more business outside the United States than inside the United States. At least today, that's what it means. And you hear all these cons go, but the stock market's going through the roof. Ain't everything wonderful? Yeah. No. The stock market is going through the roof because the American worker is getting screwed and it's profitable to corporate America. Meanwhile, you've got you've got people out there like, our good friend Dick Morris, the only conservative to ever hang up on me in the 5 years that I've been doing this radio program in the noon to three Eastern time slot here. The only guy to ever hang up on me. I had the temerity to mention the word hooker, and that was the end of that. Anyhow, yesterday on Fox News, talking about how important it is to keep Americans in Iraq so they can be shot at. No, I kid you not. After all, terrorists value their convenience, and so if we can keep supplying them with Americans to shoot at, that will make them happy. Dick Morris on Fox News.
I think that withdrawal from Iraq, it obviously gives al-Qaeda a huge victory, On the other hand, if we stay in Iraq, it gives them the opportunity to kill more Americans, which they really like. One of the things, though, that I think the anti-war crowd has not considered is that if we're putting the Americans right within their arm's reach, they don't have to come to Wall Street to kill Americans. They don't have to knock down the Trade Center. They can do it around the corner. And convenience is a big factor when you're a terrorist.
Yeah, right. So I don't even have a comment on that. I mean, I do. This is called the flypaper strategy. The Republicans have been promoting this thing for years. Let's fight them over there so we don't have to fight them here. Well, if we weren't there, we wouldn't be fighting them. They would not care about us. I mean, it's pretty simple. And in fact, if you want to extend that flypaper strategy, let's find another 15 or 20 countries in the world where they're not real happy with America. Or frankly, 99% of all countries in the world don't like to be occupied. I know the people here in the United States didn't like it. In 1776, we kicked out the British. We did it again in 1812. Nobody likes being occupied. So let's go find a few other countries and occupy them so they can get all upset and start shooting at our troops. And that way, maybe they won't want to come here. Welcome to the wonderful world of Fox News logic. It's amazing. Kurt in Greenville, South Carolina, listening on WPEK. Hey, Kurt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks a lot for your show. It's like a thinking man's retreat during lunchtime. It's awesome.
Well, thank you, Kurt.
I appreciate it. There's a couple of things I want to talk to you about. One is I'm kind of in the financial business, and I enjoy minority status as a liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Your monopoly statement is right on, but it's more prevalent than even you hinted at with these investment banking houses and investment houses. They're buying up companies left and right under a holding company. And they're peeling off pieces of those sub-companies however they want to because they all have seats on the board and monopolizing in massive amounts left and right. And I'm not just talking about a Kohlberg Kravitz or one of these other LLPs out there.
Right.
They are massively peeling off every small bit of America they can because the folks that own shares and have invested in those holding companies will get everything.
Right. What we are seeing is the deconstruction of American industry and American business in favor of multinational and international ownership and the transfer of real assets and real production overseas to cheap labor countries and in some cases companies. But by and large, this is within companies. And the big winners are the stockholders and the people on the boards of directors and the CEO class.
Exactly. The average Joe that has a 401k with some mutual funds, he's buying shares in those companies. He's not making the real money. The guys in those holding companies, like a Carlyle or something, those are the guys that are making the top dollar.
Yeah.
You know, it goes back to
They're even owning a different class of stock.
Exactly. You know, it's that myth of privatization. It really is that everything, if it gets privatized and a business can run it more efficiency and we can make more money and it's all going it's just an absolute lie, and I see it over and over again.
Yeah.
I mean, has your cable gotten cheaper?
Exactly. Or your telephone service. I mean, I'm paying three times right now. I mean, literally more than three times for one basic telephone line with no long-distance service on it whatsoever. I am paying three times what I was paying for a telephone system, for a telephone line with all the same amenities and long distance when I lived in Vermont with Sovernet, which was a private small company competing with the big giant. And I have no other option here in Portland. And you're absolutely right, Kurt.
You know, how about a postage stamp? Has that gone down since we privatized the post office?
Yeah, well, we've only semi-privatized it, but yeah. And arguably, what's happened with postage, though, if you look at postal rates over time, they've really more or less tracked inflation. But with the big monopolies, I mean, look at your power companies, look at your oil companies, look at your gas, your price of gasoline, your telephones, and it just goes way beyond that. Thanks so much for the call. Really well said. And this is where it all began.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
The war on government itself. The war on the idea that we, the people, have any business at all, saying that this is the kind of country we want to live in. These are the rules by which we want things done. James in Houston, Texas. Hey, James.
How you doing, Tom? Hey, I love your show, man. Down here from Texas, man, a whole lot of liberals down here, but there's a few of us who really love your show. But I want to know maybe if you could talk a little bit about how Eisenhower and his economic bill arrived compared to, you know, how they have the Democratic Party in the South up under Reagan kind of changed over from Democratic to neoconservatism.
Yeah.
And,
actually, it was Franklin Roosevelt who had the Economic Bill of Rights, wasn't it?
Yes.
FDR, yeah. Which followed his Four Freedoms speech. It was called his Second Bill of Rights. It was his fourth inaugural. I could be wrong on that. But good point, James. Franklin Roosevelt. There's an entire book written about this by Cass Sunstein, which I did a review of over at Buzzflash.com. If you go over to Buzzflash.com and click on whatever my book of the month is right now, I believe it's They Thought They Were Free by Milton Mayer. You click on that book review, and there's a link from that book review to my previous book reviews, because I've been doing this for a couple, two, 3 years now for Buzzflash.com, because it's a website that's supported by selling books. And I did a review of Cass Sunstein's book, the second Bill of Rights, or Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights. It's a title very similar to that. And Roosevelt said, we need an economic Bill of Rights, not just a Bill of Rights that says, you know, that people have the right of free speech or that they have the right of privacy, but we need an economic Bill of Rights. And I think that that was one of the most important things Roosevelt ever said. He didn't live to see it happen. Harry Truman came in as president. The Republicans took control of the House and Senate in the election of 46. And that was the last we heard about. You know, we have not gone back to that. And I'm hoping that as we move forward into the new and next progressive era, and mark my words, we are moving into it, that we will be revisiting that new Bill of Rights. 45 minutes past eight.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
I'll be in Dubrovnik, Croatia for the Praxis Peace Conference, along with Tom Hayden and George Lakoff and David Corton and Francis Moore LePay, a whole bunch of great folks at the Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, Peace, Praxis Peace Conference. PraxisPeace.org is the website, June 3rd through the 9th. The conference's title is Transforming Culture from Empire to Global Community. And also this week, this very week, on May 11th, I'll be doing this program live from our affiliate KLSD AM 1360 down in San Diego. There's going to be a listener party that afternoon on May 11th at the Cosmopolitan Restaurant in San Diego Old Town, 4 to 8 p.m. And you can call 858-292-2000 for more information. Oh, my. By the way, if you are, as I am, somebody who is very, very concerned about the state of election fraud in the United States, not voter fraud, not, gee, is there some guy out there? I mean, we have, what, now 20 documented cases over 6 years. Nothing. Not where somebody is voting twice or, you know, registered in the wrong district. Not. I frankly don't care that Ann Coulter has committed voter fraud by registering at her real estate agent's house. I just don't care. I don't think it's a big deal. She's a citizen. She votes. I don't care. But election fraud is a big deal to me. The wholesale theft of our election, the corporatization of our elections, and the Tom Feeney, Clint Curtis case, Poynton case. Just check out bradblog.com. I'm not going to go into a whole rant about it right now. We will, you know, we do shows on this from time to time. But there's stuff happening, particularly with regard to that case, the Tom Feeney, Clint Curtis case, and Brad Friedman's all over it at bradblog.com. It's worth checking out. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Chris in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Not much, Tom. I'm just trying to think of an answer to your question. You know, how do we stop the madness, corporate personhood, and monopolization and all that? All I can think of is, well, short-term, elect a Democratic president that is not a part of the DLC. And long-term, the only thing I can think of is go to public financing of elections. Because we have to get to a point where our politicians, their first day in office, half their attention is not spent trying to raise money for the next election, which is where we are right now.
Yeah, I mean, a senator right now, if with the average cost of a senatorial election running around $6 million, a senator has to raise $20,000 a day for every working day that they're in the Senate. There's something fundamentally wrong with that. I mean, it's just something very fundamentally wrong with that. Chris, good point and well said. And as I said, we're going to have a defender of the DLC on as our guest in the next hour. We'll have an interesting conversation about that, no doubt. Steve in Atlanta. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, I want to talk about your first thing you talked about fair trade, free trade,
yes, sir. And so-called.
Yeah, exactly. And what frustrates me so much living down here in Georgia, which is a pretty conservative state, is the people know this. You know, if the Democrats would just shout it out, they would get so many of these voters. You know, I talked to furniture store owners and all these, and they understand it full well that the factories are closing and that, you know, they can't compete with overseas. And like you said, the Democrats are just not shouting it.
Yeah, they're not. They're afraid to talk about it because they don't want to lose their campaign contributors, because you've got these huge multinational corporations who are making an absolute fortune off this kind of thing, and they're shifting tax liabilities. You've got a factory in China, you got a factory here. You make the product in China for 25 cents, you sell the product at retail here for, say, $10. Now, what price do you sell it to yourself at? If your Chinese subsidiary is paying taxes at 3% and your U.S. subsidiary is paying taxes, corporate taxes at 35%, then what you do is you sell it to yourself at a very high price. You sell it out of China to yourself at $10, and then you sell it wholesale for $11. And you keep that profit in China and pay the corporate tax there, as opposed to, I mean, it's gaming the system. It's just a huge example of gaming the system. Bennett in Los Angeles. Hey, Bennett, what's up?
Hey, two quick points. First, on the Jimmy Carter, I mean, granted, there's no doubt the fact that the election day was the first anniversary of the hostage crisis was a huge factor. But he was in trouble even before that. You know, Reagan really tagged him in the debate with, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And you should remember there was 17% inflation, although in his defense, that was largely due to the lifting of the price controls from the Nixon era.
And the oil shock, and it was also the end of the Vietnam War. We were flushing out all that deficit spending under both Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon. But go back, Bennett, go back and look at a week-by-week timeline of the polls. And it's interesting. I heard a program about this on the radio in a car in Los Angeles a couple days ago. I mean, this guy was just going week by week. And 4 or 5 weeks out, Carter was way ahead of Reagan. Everybody understood right up until the last few weeks of the election that Carter was going to win, because everybody thought that Reagan was a right-wing nut. And it was the last 3 weeks of the election when Carter's numbers started falling like crazy. And they were falling only because the hostages were being held.
True. I mean, I worked on the Kennedy campaign in the 80s. I mean, we challenged Carter. And, mm-hmm. I mean, he was vulnerable before then. But, yeah, yeah. Definitely the hostages.
But not to Reagan.
Right. And yeah. they wanted Reagan. The second thing is that your comment about the lack of any antitrust enforcement and mergers, it highlights a very important point that voters ignore in election years, is that for Republicans, they can impact government very easily and in the weeds of bureaucracy without anyone noticing, because all they have to do is shut everything off. And then immediately it has a dramatic impact. Democrats, we're builders, and building takes time. And so it's much harder. So when people say, you know, Bush and Gore, they're alike, think about what they're going to be doing in the weeds of the bureaucracy.
Yeah, you know, it's an excellent point, Bennett. A very excellent point and very well said. And this is the point. The Wall Street Journal talking about it in a front page story today, that in the last 3 years, the Bush administration has had fewer enforcements against these huge mega mergers, the rise of monopoly, the rise of new royalty in the United States, than in the last 20 years. And 20 years isn't a great history. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Countrywide Home Loans.
Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
So who really won in 2006? Well, there's a broad consensus the Democrats did, but who among the Democrats won? And why? And how? Naftali Ben-David has written a new book called The Thumpin'. Rahm Emanuel and the Democrats learned to be ruthless and ended the Republican Revolution. And Rahm actually did some really good stuff. And then there are some of us who have some disagreements with it. Naftali Ben-David, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Great to have you with us. I should note that you're a Chicago Tribune reporter as well as the author of this, and so I'm assuming people can track down some of your writings over at chicagotribune.com.
Yeah, absolutely.
But of course, the book is the big deal, the thumping. I spent a lot of time with this book, and there's a lot of subtle and not so subtle jabs or whacks at Howard Dean and his 50-state strategy, and pointing out how Rahm Emanuel has a tendency to go obscene and go ballistic, but he gets things done. I mean, this is a very, very flattering portrait of him. And there are many of us who looked at the 2006 election and felt that Rahm Emanuel was useful and helpful in some ways, but actually was an impediment in many ways. We have a lot of progressive candidates who he didn't get behind, who did win, and a lot of the middle-of-the-road DLC Republican light candidates that he was pushing really hard who didn't win or who won by very small margins.
Yeah, I'm very well aware of that criticism, and I talk about it somewhat in the book, and I think it's a very legitimate point of view. And I my feeling at the end was that Democrats of so many different kinds of stripes won, and Republicans of so many different types lost, that you could sort of find evidence for whatever your point of view was in the results. And my sense in the end was that both Dean and Emanuel had a lot to do with the victory. They played different roles, and maybe there was some creative tension there. And I think
that's not how your book plays it. I read the entire chapter on Howard Dean, and it just made him sound like he was, you pointed out in one sentence that Dean did have responsibility for the entire Democratic Party, whereas Emanuel had responsibility for Congress, for the congressional candidates, and there was a certain dynamic tension there. But the rest of it was basically, Rahm good, Dean bad.
Well, that certainly wasn't my intent. But I think what I was trying to convey there was very much the feeling from inside Emanuel's operation. I mean, I spent a year and a half with him, and that was in large part, as you sort of alluded to, because he's a Chicago guy. We were the Chicago Tribune, and I just decided early on that I'd spend time following the Democratic campaign for Congress specifically, as opposed to the DNC in general, which, of course, was Howard Dean's operation. And I can tell you for sure that inside that campaign, there were a lot of negative feelings about Howard Dean, and as you know, there was a lot of personal animosity between the two of them, a lot of political differences about strategy, and what I was intending to convey, I guess, was some of the feeling on the part of Emanuel's team, not so much my personal feeling, because I really do think that they both had a lot to contribute. Some of what I was reacting to is an argument after the election was over that Emanuel had nothing to do with it. And I realize this isn't what you're saying, but you saw some of that kind of critique, that if anything, they could have won a ton more seats and everything he did was for the bad. And I just felt that it was a little bit questionable to have a guy who was running the whole campaign from the very beginning when the odds seemed very long, and then it ends up being successful, and then people say, that guy had nothing to do with it. And I think that's a little bit of the analysis I was trying to respond to.
Yeah, but, of his 21 first wave picks, only 9... one of his second wave picks, only 3 of them were supported by ACT. I should probably stop there. One of the things we're talking with Naftali Ben-David. He has a new book out, The Thumpin', about Rahm Emanuel and his role with the Democratic Party. And we're accused of being a circular firing squad, and I don't want to turn this into that.
Right.
And as you probably figured out by this point, I'm not a fan of Rahm Emanuel, and I am a fan of Howard Dean, but I'm also a proponent. I'm not a member of the Democratic Party, but I'm a proponent of the Democratic Party and the ideals that it stands for. And so, it's like, how do we? I guess here's the larger question. You would acknowledge, I'm assuming, that a lot of the Democrats who won, and of course many people suggest that the majority of Democrats who won were as a result of Act Blue, Move On, Marcos, Dilicos, Jane Duncan, Howard Dean, and a lot of progressive forces in the United States, and some of those Democrats who won as a result of Rahm Emanuel's efforts. So are we more or less in agreement on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think your point's well taken, that there is this tendency sometimes in the Democratic Party to really fire at each other. And I thought it was pretty interesting how right after really this, what should have been a tremendous victory, it took very little time for people to start arguing with each other about who is at fault and so forth. But I think the larger question really there was the direction of the party in the future. And I think the reason that these arguments still have resonance is that there's some very important questions out there that have to do with the kind of candidates and the kind of messages the party should promote in the future, and that seems to me like a very important discussion for the party to have.
Yeah, I think it is too, and it's a conversation that I'm not hearing the party have a lot, and you know we're seeing all these articles now about how you know K Street is now starting to move big corporate money into the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. and Democrats are suddenly moving more in the direction of the DLC of the what I refer to as Republican light Democrats, and you know I'm reminded of Harry Truman's. Today's Harry Truman's birthday, his famous saying that if a voter is confronted with a choice between a Democrat who behaves like a Republican or a Republican, and keep in mind Harry Truman was a Democrat, he said the voter will choose the real Republican every time. In other words, people are more interested in people who are consistent with their philosophy and their integrity than they are necessarily with somebody who is just a particular political label. And how do we reconcile those folks in the Democratic Party who are in favor of things like free trade and NAFTA and CAFTA and all this kind of stuff and vote for the bankruptcy bill to help the, you know, the big credit card companies and whatnot versus those who are pushing for the progressives in the party who are pushing for things like national health care and you know the things that are at the forefront of the progressive agenda that the DLC is, if not openly hostile to, certainly very, very wary of.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that those things can be reconciled necessarily. I mean, it may be one of those tensions that has to exist in the party for a while. But one of the things that I was interested in is some of the areas in which there seemed to be common ground. For example, there was a candidate in North Carolina who's gotten a certain amount of attention, Heath Shuler. And he's somebody who socially was very conservative, very much against abortion, against gun control, that sort of thing. Economically, he was something of a populist, actually. And maybe I missed it, but I didn't see a lot of attacks from the progressive wing of the party on him. There seemed to be a certain understanding that, look, you can either cede that district to the Republicans or you can win with that kind of candidate. And it just felt to me like there's certain kind of a rough consensus emerging beyond social issues being a little less orthodox and a little less rigid, but on economic issues being a little more populist and really adhering to some of those fair trade issues, minimum wage type issues. And so it may be, I don't know, but it may be that the party sort of haltingly and with a lot of bloodletting is moving towards some kind of a rough consensus in those things.
I sure hope so, because that's where they're going to win. I mean, look at Bernie Sanders, who's neither a Democrat nor a Republican. I mean, so we can look at him completely outside the frame of what impact the party had. You know, Howard Dean had nothing to do with him winning, and neither did Rahm Emanuel. And Bernie, in the Northeast Kingdom, in those parts of Vermont, and I lived for 10 years in Vermont. I'm speaking from firsthand knowledge here. And Bernie's on this program every Friday. Bernie in the most rural, most poverty-racked and most Republican part of the state of Vermont that George Bush carried with three-quarters of the vote in both 2000 and 2004, Bernie was carrying in the 80% range because he's out there speaking an economic populist message. And it really, really, truly resonates. Look at Brian Schweitzer in Montana. You know, the progressives, the economic progressives, set aside guns, gays, and God, the economic progressives are the ones who really seem to be winning the elections.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for that, and that's why I say, to the extent that, you know, when I try to sit back and answer some of the very questions that you're asking, which I think are really good ones and important ones for the party, it seems to me that if there was any kind of a consensus, and Democrats, you know, I mean, they always seem very willing to fight among themselves.
Right, the Will Rogers joke, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That seems to be perhaps changing a little bit. I think people got so tired of losing that it caused people to mute some of their differences. But I think this idea of being socially a little little bit more of a Big Ten party, but economically very populist, seems to me to be gaining a certain amount of currency on the party.
I sure hope so, because I think that's how the Democratic Party could take the White House and the House for a generation. Naftali Ben-David is the author of The Thumpin', How Rahm Emanuel and the Democrats Learned to Be Ruthless and Ended the Republican Revolution. Naftali, thanks for being with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
It's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
Liberal.
Welcome back to the middle of the vast liberal conspiracy. 21 minutes past the hour. By the way, a special call out and thanks to Alex Goldmark. He's been working with us on this program very often, running the board and doing other things that make the program work for the better part of a couple of years. And he's off to produce The Lionel Show on Air America Radio starting, I think, next week. I believe it's next week, Alex. And so, Alex, thank you for all of the time that you've shared with us, and we wish you well, and we know that you're going to help make The Lionel Show a great program, and we wish Lionel the very best as well. Yesterday, I told a story about, on the program, this is apropos of nothing in the news, but just how we had seen, Louise had seen one of the baby geese are hatching, and the baby ducks are hatching in our backyard, which is the river that we live in. And yesterday, a merganser, which is it looks like a duck, only it's kind of like funny red crest on its head. I used to call them Chinese diving ducks because they come, like 20, 30 of them come in, and they just all dive underwater at once, except the one that keeps a lookout, and then they go down underwater and fish, and then whoop, 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 they appear, and it's almost like ballet. It's beautiful. Anyhow, this merganser went by, this female, with about 10 or 12 babies, half of them on her back. I'd never seen anything like it before. I'm yelling, Louise, look at this. And because we'd lived here 2 years and the geese are out. You know, our Gusolini is out with his babies, and, you know, the geese and the ducks are, they haven't started yet. Their eggs haven't started yet hatching, but they will any day. But this was a merganser. And then after that, maybe, I don't know, a half hour after that, we just heard this beep, 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 chip, chip, out back. And we went out, and there's this one little merganser chick that somehow got separated from mom, and he was going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth across our little part of the river, you know, calling for mom. And I'm thinking, oh, man, it's hawk food. And he a couple of geese families went by, and he tried to hook up with them, and none of them would have him. And when we finally went to sleep last night, he was still going back and forth, peep, peep, peeping. And so hopefully he found mom. But it's amazing to watch nature. It's just absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. Anyhow, conservatives, you're welcome to call the program anytime you'd like. Most often they don't. Instead, they just send me emails. So here's our conservative email for the day.
Go ahead. Make my day.
Yeah, right. From Glenn, I'm not gonna, you know, trash the guy by giving you his name and email address or anything like that. But anyhow, Glenn sends this email. He says, President Reagan won the Cold War. His domestic policies rejuvenated the American economy and continue to this day. Apparently, your anger that liberals such as LBJ and Jimmy Carter were unable to accomplish anything. End of sentence. And by the way, history will show George W. Bush to be a foreign policy visionary and hero. As long as Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton are not stripped of their positions posthumously, Mr. Bush will never be the worst president. Best Glenn. Okay. You know, I don't know what this guy has been smoking. You know, it's or drinking or whatever. It's Reagan brought us the $3.5 trillion debt. Any economic growth that can be attributed to him goes back to that. And then he brought us the beginning of this of modern neoliberalism. Not liberal in the good sense. The Chicago school, as it were, which led right up to the Telecommunications Act of 1996, you know, where you had these huge, beginning in the mid-1980s and extending into the 90s, each of the three major television networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, was purchased by another corporation. In 1980, Cap Cities bought ABC for $3.5 billion. GE bought RCA. 95, GE purchased NBC. Westinghouse purchased CBS in 94 for $5.4 billion. Walt Disney purchased Cap Cities for $19 billion. I mean, this is just in that world. And then the aluminum business. This is also in today's Wall Street Journal. I mean, this gets us back to this issue of when are the Democrats going to start talking about the real economic issues that are whacking the American middle class? The European Union has decided to cut their aluminum tariffs. Frankly, I think they're making a terrible mistake. But Alan Greenspan, there was a judgment against Alcoa, the U.S. versus Alcoa, and Judge Learned Hand, this was some many years back, and Greenspan criticized this. Learned Hand said that Alcoa insists that it never excluded competitors, but we can think of no more effective exclusion then progressively to embrace each new opportunity as it opened and to face every newcomer with new capacity already geared into a great organization having the advantage of experience, trade connections, and the elite of personnel. In other words, monopolies destroy America. When is the Democratic Party going to start to stand up and say, no, we are opposed to monopolies? And I think it's starting to happen, and I think it's the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. I think it's the progressive wing of the Democratic Party that won the elections of 2006, that put a majority into the House of Representatives and the Senate, and that's going to do it in 2008. 27 minutes past.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
I heard a voice. I thought it was God. It said,
"You're wrong, man, and your system is wrong."
It was so scary. I was so terrified. That morning, I decided it was time to change sides. I'm a Republican now. Party elect. I'm a Republican now.
I got red on my neck.
I'm a Republican now.
We ain't having no sex.
I'm holier than now. I'm a Republican now.
You and Tom DeLay. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. A call out, as it were. Hey, you know, congratulations. Well done. Well done to Lee Iacocca. Of all people, Lee Iacocca, the former chairman CEO of Chrysler. His new book, Where Have All the Leaders Gone? An excerpt from it at the top of commondreams.org. He says, had enough. Am I the only guy in this country who's fed up with what's happening? Where the hell is our outrage? We should be screaming bloody murder. We've got a gang of clueless bozos steering our ship of state right over a cliff. We've got corporate gangsters stealing us blind, and we can't even clean up after a hurricane, much less build a hybrid car. But instead of getting mad, everyone sits around and nods their heads while the politicians say, stay the course. Stay the course? You gotta be kidding. This is America, not the damn Titanic. I'll give you a soundbite. Throw the bombs out! And that's just how he starts. Lee Iacocca, good on you. He's been a good Democrat for a lot of years. 1-866-303-2270, Jerry in Long Island. Hey, Jerry.
Very much for taking my call. Yeah, I like what Lee Iacocca was saying.
But with respect to your last guest, I think Howard Dean was right on target when he suggested it was collectively we the American people and not Rahm Emanuel or the DLC that deserves the most credit for the Democrats winning a majority in both houses of Congress. And also, I would say that amongst all Americans, collectively, progressive registered independent voters such as myself joining the Democratic friends on both economic issues and the war in Iraq and voting Republicans out of office also made one of the biggest differences in the 2006 election results.
Absolutely right, Jerry. And speaking as a registered independent, I agree. And I thought it was interesting that after the elections, the DLC was aggressively out there doing the talk show circuit saying, we won. And Howard Dean was being relatively quiet until he was called upon. And at least that's my recollection of it. So, good point. Frederick in Portland, Maine, listening on The Voice. Hey, Frederick.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I am, too. We've got spring happening here in Maine, finally.
Yeah.
I give great kudos, too, to Howard Dean. And, you know, progressives missed a great opportunity when we did not come down to Washington en masse and celebrate our collective victory to take the credit where we deserved as the force that helped elect this new majority. Go ahead.
I was going to say, increasingly the problem with getting people out into the streets is that because of 26 years of conservative economic policies that have eviscerated the middle class, that have done away with the safety net of things like pensions and, you know, fully paid health insurance is totally transportable from job to job and all these other things, you have people who just can't afford, I mean, they literally can't afford to take a couple days off and get on a bus and go to Washington or get on a plane.
Well, you know, had the Netroots and other progressive elements had raised millions to win this election, don't you think that with Air America's help, the Netroots and progressive Democrats could have raised millions to get people from the Eastern Seaboard and the Midwest to Washington like the right wing did in 1978 when they took out their first moderate Republican, I believe a sitting congressman in Alabama with a right winger. They were en masse at the state capitol and in Washington celebrating their first victory. We missed a great opportunity, I think.
Yeah, well, that's an
interesting
point of view.
I wanted to talk to you about the vision of the Democratic Party. I think you hit upon a great point where when you and your guests were speaking about we not agreeing, and I feel that's due to us not having an underlying vision that we can rally around, and I believe you speak to that vision when you speak that we are the standard bearers of the public good versus the threat of privatization.
Yeah, and that the Democratic Party reflects values that were held by its creator, Thomas Jefferson. The idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the essential core issues of, you know, promoting the general welfare that are embodied in the preamble of the Constitution. Now, good point, Frederick, and well made. And I think that the Democrats, frankly, do have a vision. I think that what we're talking about is a difference in how to accomplish it. And there are some people who have drunkenly Tom Friedman and, for that matter, Milton Friedman Kool-Aid, the olive tree Lexus world is flat nonsense, and there are and you know, God bless them, they think it's the best way to make a better world. I really think that most of them do. Some of them obviously are in the pockets of the big corporations who are profiting off this, but I think a lot of these folks really think this is how to make the world a better place. All I would suggest they do is look at the last 26 years and look at what it's brought us. It hasn't worked. It has brought us huge record corporate profits, a huge, you know, a great run-up in the stock market, the rich getting richer and the middle class getting wiped out. You have CEOs pulling down billion-dollar compensation packages, thousands of millions of dollars, and the average guy, the average worker out there getting screwed. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I was going to call in about a war protest, but this is an issue. Free trade is a nightmare, and so I'm really glad that you're spending so much time on it.
Well, you're welcome. Did you have a point you wanted to make about it?
I volunteer for an organization called America in Solidarity, and issues that in universal health care and ending the war. And in addition to just calling members of Congress and so on, folks can actually, you know, get involved in groups like ours and just start new groups in their area around these working class, you know, working people issues. It's really important.
Yeah,
and it really makes a difference.
Yep, you're absolutely right, Jeff, and it is. And there's a lot of groups out there, Democracy for America, TrueMajority.org, DemocracyForAmerica.com, which is Jim Dean's group, Howard Dean's brother, TrueMajority.org, put together by Ben Cohen and friends, Ben of Ben and Jerry's. And there's no shortage of active groups who have cells, who have groups, who actually get together, people getting together all around the country. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just thought of something that we could put to the test as far as where the DLC is at. Yesterday was the poison pill amendment, as Senator Bernie Sanders had talked about last week, where they brought up an amendment to add to the bill that would allow American citizens to buy prescription drugs from overseas.
Right, and the vote was 49-40.
Yes, that means that probably 10 Democrats just did not vote, which That's allowed right. the amendment to be passed. And I'd be curious to find out who those 10 Democrats were, and are they DLC Democrats?
Yeah, well, David has the website to find out, you know, where the votes are and things like that. We'll track that down, and I'll get back with you, Julian, on that. That's a good point. It's a good question to raise, is who was voting how on that poison pill amendment yesterday. I saw a piece on it on Think Progress earlier. And it probably has a place where you can drill down. We'll have to track it down. Rick, let's go from Grand Rapids to Grand Rapids. Hey, Rick, WTKG is
on the air
today. Hey, Rick.
I wanted to comment on, I don't know how often you watch what Keith Olbermann calls Fox Noise,
mm-hmm.
but Mr. O'Reilly has been doing a hit piece lately on George Soros, whom he calls...
Yeah, I have to confess, I other than watching myself on the DVR... When I was on Fox last Sunday,
I haven't
watched Fox television in probably 2 years, so I'm clueless with
it. Well, what O'Reilly's been doing is he's been doing a series of hit pieces on George Soros, whom he blames for all the evil on the road. He says he's a billionaire who's advancing the liberal cause. Mm-hmm. I guess it somehow escaped Mr. O'Reilly's notice that he's working for a guy who's a right-wing billionaire that's trying to advance the conservative cause, and I'm just wondering why nobody calls him on this.
Well, nobody calls him on it because he controls the microphone.
No, but I mean, even Olbermann, who's usually going after him, you know, hasn't mentioned this. I mean, it's just such a ludicrous proposition to condemn a billionaire who's a liberal for wanting to be politically involved, and when O'Reilly works for someone on the other side of the spectrum is doing the same thing.
Yeah, well, and beyond that, it's ludicrous to condemn somebody for being a billionaire. If you don't think that people should be able to accumulate such massive amounts of money, then you change the rules.
Well, I don't think it's against people having money, because he has quite a bit, too. But apparently it's okay to be a conservative billionaire, but not a liberal billionaire. I guess that's how the rules work at Fox.
Yeah. In all probability, that's the official policy on the Bill O'Reilly Show. So, Alan, thanks, Rick. Alan in Orange, Texas. Hey, Alan.
Yes, occasionally I'll listen to this public radio program called Marketplace.
Yes.
And I hear some of the most ridiculous things on there, even though I don't listen to it very often. One time I was listening to it, and they were saying that Samuel Adams would have been real proud of our trade policies with China.
You're kidding.
Another time.
Sam Adams was one of the big proponents of the Boston Tea Party.
Yeah.
I mean, he fought against a multinational corporation.
Yeah, and another time they said Citibank, their jobs that they are outsourcing are considered to be sunset jobs, and what we need is sunrise jobs.
Yeah.
And another
go ahead.
And another time they said that union jobs, if only employees knew that unions, to be in a union, you'd have money taken out of your paycheck, they'd be against it.
Yeah, I think union members understand that they're getting something for their money. They're getting a better paycheck, they're getting benefits, they're getting somebody representing them, they're getting democracy in the workplace. And in fact, the majority of Americans, working Americans, if given an opportunity to join a union, would do so. Every survey shows that. 45, thanks to Alan for that. 45 minutes past.
Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
and another new gun. I'm a Republican now. Criticism is swag. I'm a Republican now. And nobody checks. I'm a Republican now. We still ain't having no sex. I'm holier than now. I'm a Republican now.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. It looks like the Democrats have got their act together with regard to the legislation that they're going to provide for continuing funding of the occupation of Iraq, what the Republicans like to refer to as a war. This Ann Flaherty with the Associated Press writing, House Democratic leaders plan to brief party members today on new legislation that would fund the Iraq war through July. See, even the Associated Press is calling it a war. I'm sorry, the war ended on May 1st of 2003. That was the end of the war. It's been an occupation ever since then. In any case, to fund the war through July, then give Congress the option of cutting off money after that if conditions do not improve. See, if every single Democrat started using the word occupation whenever they refer to Iraq, things would change really rapidly. And I've been saying this for 3 years now. But in any case, back to Ann Flaherty's article in the Associated Press. If members agree to back the plan as expected, a vote on the new war spending bill could come as early as this week. This is a proposal that was pitched last week by David Obey of Wisconsin. And basically saying, you know, okay, you've got 3 more months. Because right now, actually, Bush has enough money through August, so this may even be a cutback, as it were. But, you've got money through July, and then you have to come back to us. So the Congressman John Boehner of Ohio comes out and says, Democrats should not treat our men and women in uniform like they are children who are getting a monthly allowance. And Adam Putnam, the Republican from Florida, says, it's an irresponsible approach. You do not fund wars 60 days at a time. Well, let's see. What does the Constitution have to say about this? First of all, powers granted to Congress. This is Article 1 of the Constitution, Section 8. Powers granted to Congress to declare war, Paragraph 11. But then that's followed by Paragraph 12. To raise and support armies, but no appropriation for that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years. In other words, every 2 years, Congress has to decide whether or not they're going to continue to fund any sort of military activity. And paragraph 16, these are powers granted to Congress, not to the president, to Congress. To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. The Republicans saying, "Oh, this is irresponsible. Congress is not supposed to have any say in this." These guys who've never bothered to read the Constitution. It boggles my mind. So, you know, my first suggestion was Congress. Should simply send the exact same piece of legislation back over and over and over again. Apparently, they're not going to do that. Instead, they're going to say, fine, Bush, fine Republicans, actually. And this is another thing, a strategic, as it were, thing that Democrats should be paying attention to, is not referring to this as Bush and Bush's work, because Bush is not running for re-election in 2008. He's not running for anything. He's toast. He's gone. He's politically out of the sphere of things. They should be, Democrats should be referring to this as the Republican War, or the failed Republican occupation of Iraq. And so if they're going to fund, if the Republicans are insisting that they continue to have funds for their failed occupation of Iraq, Democrats are saying, fine, you can have 2 more months, 3 more months, that's okay, and then come back to us and ask again, because we're in charge now. And a fine thing it is. Joel at Berkeley, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Joel, what's up?
Hey, got a few things on my mind that the screener said I can only talk about once. So on the subject of Ronald Reagan, I don't know if you saw it, but the March 26th cover of Time magazine, the cover story, first of all, the picture was a mugshot of Ronnie with a tear rolling down his cheek. The cover story was how the right went wrong, what would Ronnie do, and why the Republican candidates need to reclaim the Reagan legacy.
I know. I read that, and I thought it was just absolutely tragic. And that was, and thank you, Joel, and that was right after I was broadcasting from the CPAC conference, the conservative political action group in Washington, D.C., and every speaker invoked Ronald Reagan's name, as we saw with the Republican candidates the other day. And what people don't remember is that Ronald Reagan essentially began the destruction of this nation. And for that matter, they say, well, Ronald Reagan won the Cold War. Sorry, that happened when George Herbert Walker Bush was president, was when Gorbachev and Yeltsin collided, and Yeltsin had his way, and the Soviet Union got broken up. Paul in Hudson, Florida. Hey, Paul.
What I wanted to say was kind of on the topic you just brought up was the Democrat strategy, you know, how you just said that they should be calling it an occupation. Well, every time the Republicans use a phrase like, you know, don't support the troops, see, the Democrats need to get into their psychology that they're being attacked, being hit at by the Republicans, and they need to come back with, you know, they need to have lines for every one of these things that they come back with, and the line for their no support the troops is, you know, who sent them into a war based on lies? Who sent them without equipment?
Right.
Just list that whole list of things.
But we support the troops who are bringing them home.
Yeah.
Yeah, support the troops, bring them home. I mean, it's very simple stuff. If you really want to be supporting the troops, thank you, Paul. Good point and well made. If you really want to be supporting the troops, bring them home. You know, bring in the other countries in the region and let them help the Iraqi government sort this thing out if the Iraqi government can actually stand. And if it can't stand, then I guarantee you, the other countries in the region, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Iran, they don't want a failed state on their borders. None of them do. Jordan's going to get involved in this thing. Let the countries that are contiguous with Iraq and largely the other Muslim countries in the area, let the Arab League get involved. They have all been staying totally away. Instead, in Saudi Arabia, they're doing fundraisers for you know what, terrorists and things. I mean, to fund more outreach programs for Wahhabism. It's frankly tragic. And then the Republicans go off and they, we're not supporting the troops, we're not supporting. No, it's got nothing to do with supporting or not supporting the troops. This has to do with whether or not this occupation, whether or not any more American blood should be spilled on a failed Republican occupation. 57 years ago.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. What is journalism? What is objectivity? Is objectivity even desirable in journalism? Is it even possible in journalism? To what extent have the media played a role in promoting the destruction of the American middle class? To what extent have they ignored the consequences of, for example, the so-called global free trade and its devastation to the American middle class because they're the same corporations that are profiting from it? To what extent is advocacy an issue as opposed to reporting? David Sirota is one of the most just solid spot-on writers in a whole broad area of these issues. He's the author of his latest book, Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government, How We Can Take It Back. His website, davidsirota.com. His most recent piece, The Great Objectivity Scam. David Sirota, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Tom.
Oh, it's always great talking with you, David. You're one of the most rational voices out there. Let me play just a very short segment from CBS last night, 60 Minutes, or not last night, Sunday night, where Leslie Stahl is taking on Lou Dobbs. Or I don't know, maybe this is one coming up. I'm not sure. This is Think Progress has it over on their website, thinkprogress.org. Here's Leslie Stahl and Lou Dobbs.
Well, here's what they say about you,
mm-hmm.
that you distort the figures, that you exaggerate, and you aim to inflame just to get ratings.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really.
That's fascinating, because what I can't understand is why other journals would not take on the issues of free trade, illegal immigration, outsourcing, all of these rather sexy topics.
I'll tell you why.
Which I've been covering for years.
Reporters don't take on issues. Reporters report issues, and there's a big difference there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you're a journalist?
Absolutely. I may be an advocacy journalist, but I'm a journalist.
So there's really three or four different issues rolled into that little sound bite there, David. First of all, the state of journalism in America.
Yeah, I mean, the key point here is that reporters don't take on issues. That's CBS's response to Dobbs saying, you know, I've been covering major economic issues. I think that's just ridiculous. I mean, reporters make all sorts of subjective decisions all the time about what to cover, what not to cover, who to quote, who not to quote, and which sides of the story to present. I mean, here, just let's take Dobbs, you know, free trade. I mean, you have a media right now that is choosing, making a subjective decision to spend much, much, much more of its time covering issues like John Edwards' haircut, covering campaign plane gossip, than you do, say, about these ongoing trade negotiations between Congress and the White House, which could be the most far-reaching trade negotiations that affect middle-class, ordinary people's job security, health care benefits, wages. You know, that's a subjective decision about what to cover and what not to cover. And so I think Stahl's claim that, you know, reporters don't decide what to cover is just absurd.
I would suggest that probably 95% of Americans don't even know what fast track is, much less that this is on the table.
Exactly.
For example.
And the crime of that, of course, is that fast track, you know, which is the ability of a president to strip out basic labor, human rights, and environmental provisions from international trade deals. The fact that the public doesn't know much about that is not because the issue isn't going to affect the public's daily life. It isn't because it's not going to affect people's job security, health care benefits, wages, environment, et cetera, et cetera. It's because the media has decided, reporters have decided, for various reasons, that that's not something that they're going to cover. And obviously, some of that decision is that it's just easier not to cover a complicated issue like that. Some of that decision is that the companies that own the media are very, very pro free trade, pro these policies that hurt the middle class. They don't want to talk about it. But that is a biased, subjective decision to cover something and to not cover something.
Yeah, and fast track, I mean, the bottom line is that the Constitution explicitly gives Congress the right to ratify treaties. And, for example, even trade agreements. And fast track allows the president to basically ignore Congress and just go ahead and do it. And if my understanding of this is correct, and you know, there are constitutional issues there. There are, frankly, in my opinion, although you know, I guess that's probably relatively decided. And the impact on the people of the fact that all of these trade agreements with fast track, or many of these trade agreements, will simply happen simply because the president just does it. Nobody's even noticing.
That's opposed
to there being an open debate in Congress.
That's exactly right. And what Lou Dobbs is basically saying is that, look, you know, if my coverage of trade or outsourcing was done out of specifically a desire just to get ratings, why haven't other reporters, other shows covered the same issue? And you know, I have an interview with him from my new book that I'm reporting, where he said, you know, if a reporter typically walks into their editor's office and says, I want to report on trade and job outsourcing as a way to get ratings, their editor would laugh them out of the room. Now I say that, you know, not necessarily agreeing with everything Lou Dobbs, you know, advocates for, but the point that I said is that I'd rather have somebody like Lou Dobbs tell me where he's coming from, be very upfront about what he's advocating for, rather than get my news from media operations that pretend they don't have an agenda when in fact they have a very, very equally as aggressive an agenda as Dobbs.
Don't we have a situation here now, David Sirota, where these monopolies, these huge media monopolies, who are heavily into the defense industry and for example, we just had this revelation that George Tenet took millions of dollars from corporations in the defense industry that are profiting from the war in Iraq. And it's not mentioned in this book, and it was not mentioned in any of the news reports about him. And it's just kind of leaking out now through the progressive media, the progressive press. people look at that and they go, oh my God, that's a terrible thing. That's George Tenet. He must be a bad guy or whatever. I mean, you know, they were quick to condemn an individual and at the level of personal sin. And yet we have corporations that are profiting enormously off the war in Iraq. I mean, NBC is a, or General Electric, rather, is a major defense contractor that owns NBC. And it's an issue that not once have I heard discussed in the mainstream media.
Right, and that's not an accident, because the mainstream media doesn't have an interest in talking or even looking critically at those issues, because many of those issues revolve around either the companies that own the media or the companies that the media relies on for advertising revenue. So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the issue of media ownership in this country stifles debate on literally the most important issues. And so I think there's reason to be optimistic. I mean, I think you've got some courageous journalists working in the system who are able to at least focus on some of these issues. Trade and outsourcing, right? And I do think that you have, you know, the internet and new media is getting the word out in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we have to understand that the debate in this country on major issues is artificially narrowed in order to push an agenda. I mean, that's what I was really saying, is that the act of omitting topics from the agenda is as subjective and as important to news coverage in this country as what actually does get covered.
Yeah, we have over 40 million people who have no health insurance in this country, and probably another 50 or 60 million who have such clunky health insurance that if they got really sick, they're going to end up in bankruptcy court. That's probably at least 100 million people, at least a third of the population. Nowhere near as many people who are going to be, for example, victims of crimes or, you know, in a car accident or something. But what does the news focus on? When was the last time there was a really good story about how we don't have health insurance? It seems to me, David, we only have a minute before we've got to wrap this up. It seems to me that the solution to this is to go back to enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act that Reagan's, for all practical purposes, suspended in 82, and start breaking up some of these very, very large corporations.
I think looking into that is extremely important. I think the idea of the general concept of the public owning its own airwaves, as opposed to giving them away to big corporations without any requirement that those airwaves are used for anything, such as covering real issues.
But this is also meta to a much larger issue. I mean, this is, you know, right across the board. You've got these mergers in aluminum right now. I mean, it's just the lack of the ability of anybody to enter into the marketplace because of these giant monopolies.
That's exactly right, and it's particularly hypocritical for a country that supposedly prides itself on small business people, on the entrepreneur, and on competition. That's really the hypocrisy.
Yeah, well said. David Sirota, davidsirota.com, the website, his newest book, Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Can Take It Back. You can read his article about the great objectivity scam over at davidsirota.com. David, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Marion Wright Edelman with the Children's Defense Fund up next. Stick around. This is going to be interesting.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Young man, I found politics in Bush's army door, and I got real good at dirty tricks. My name, sir, is Karl Rove. Oh, Dick Cheney, don't you cry for me, 'cause when your administration's gone, the right will kiss my knee.
Hey, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour.
Well,
Tom Hartman here with you.
The
All Healthy Children Act, House Resolution 1688, H.R. 1688, has been put forward by Congressman Bobby Scott, the Democrat from Virginia, with the help and assistance of the Children's Defense Fund. The ChildrensDefenseFund.org, the website. They're also running an extraordinary candidate for president. Marion Wright Edelman is the president of the Children's Defense Fund and our guest on the program right now, Marion Wright Edelman. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Let me just play a clip of this spot, if I may.
That'd be great.
Susie Flynn.
Hello, my name is Susie Flynn. Today, I'm announcing my intention to run for president to help the 9 million children in America with no health insurance. It's every child's right to have access to health care, yet our government continues to ignore the fact that one child in nine is uninsured. It's time to stop talking and start acting. These children need a solution now. If you elect me as your next president, every child will get the health insurance they deserve.
This is, you can see these over at electsusie.com is the website. Marion Wright Edelman, the fact of the matter is, Susie says every child has a right to health care, but conservatives in this country, and in particular the Republican Party, would aggressively argue with that. They would say there is no such right.
Well, there ought to be, as there is in every other industrialized nation, is a very basic human right in a democratic country that's the wealthiest in the world, for every child to live. I don't think there are any conservative Republicans who wouldn't want their own child to have health care. And these children did not choose their parents or the lottery of geography or the state they were born in, and they should not be punished for things over which they had no control. We say every child, is every person in America, has certain inalienable rights, including the right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, and so I hope that will include children. We insure every senior person, and I know that every parent or grandparent listening to this call would think it intolerable if they were not able to get their children basic health care as every other industrialized nation provides. And, you know, I just think it's time for us to kind of come into the civilized world and to say to our children that we value your life after birth as whatever your political point of view, and that we're going to make sure that you can survive and thrive and learn in school and become productive, self-sufficient citizens.
What are the provisions of the All Healthy Children Act, H.R. 1688, that you're promoting?
The All Healthy Children Act really means that we would provide health care, and it is the only pending child health bill that would provide health care to every child in America now as the State Children's Health Insurance Program comes up for reauthorization. Single eligibility standard of 300% of poverty, which is about $62,000, and anybody with income over that could buy in at an affordable cost, because health insurance in the private market is not affordable for most Americans. It costs, you know, about $12,000 a year. Third is that we would blend and make one simple bureaucracy with one single eligibility standard. Right now, 5 to 6 million children who are currently eligible for Children's Medicaid or for the State Children's Health Insurance Program fall through the bureaucratic cracks. So we would have one simple bureaucracy and make children able to be automatically enrolled at birth, or if they're in a free or reduced price lunch program or any other means-tested program. The value in the All Healthy Children's Act is that all children should get preventive, cost-effective health care and be able to do well in life and do well in school. The other thing that the All Healthy Children's Act will do is to try to equalize the reimbursement rates from providers that serve children who now get far less than providers that serve the elderly or disabled under Medicare or under private insurance plans. And so we would give children all the same access to health care that their seniors and grandfathers do have. And finally, we would make sure that all medically necessary services are provided to children, including dental, mental, and other health services. We've lost 3 children in the last 2 months, 2 of whom died from tooth abscesses because they couldn't find a dentist and their parents had fallen through the cracks of the system. And we lost a 3rd child who had advanced kidney cancer because they got wrangled up in the bureaucracy between CHIP and Medicaid in Texas. Shouldn't happen in America.
You're absolutely right. We have less than a minute left. We're talking with Marion Wright Edelman. She's the president of the Children's Defense Fund, childrensdefensefund.org. You are up against one of the largest and most well-funded lobbying institutions in the country, the health insurance industry. How are you going to do here with H.R. 1688, and how can we help?
Well, what you can help is to tell your listeners to let their voices be heard, to call their senators and to call their representatives and say children should have health coverage. And this is not about money and profits. This is not about partisan politics or special interests. This is about being a decent, compassionate, and sensible country, because it saves money to invest in children preventively, and they are the most cost-effective group, and we just need to do what every other country does in the wealthy industrialized world and say our children, who are all of our futures, that we're going to value you and take care of you and make you productive, educated citizens. So let your congressman hear from you.
Yeah, there you go. And the telephone number for Congress, by the way, 202-225-3121 will get you to the switchboard. Give me your zip code, and they'll tell you who your member of the House of Representatives is if you don't know, and who your two senators are. Marianne Wright Edelman, thanks so much for being with us.
And thank you.
Great talking with you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. The Children's Defense Fund website, childrensdefensefund.org, and electsusie, SUSIE.com. is the website for the their candidate. 27 minutes past here.
We're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
In the chat room, one of our conservative trolls says, I think Tom should be broadcasting on Air Al-Qaeda. I'm sure that their message is very much the same. I just keep waiting for Tom to shout Allah Akbar. Well, actually, it's George W. Bush who is doing exactly what Al-Qaeda wants. This is the tragedy of conservatives who run around with opinions and don't bother to read the news or you know, dig into the facts. Zawahiri recently released a videotape in which he said, please do not pull out of Iraq. Please stay in Iraq because he said, Al-Qaeda wants to kill another 100,000 or 200,000 Americans. They are looking to make that their training ground. And the Republican Party, of course, wants to give it to them as their training ground. You got, you know, Dick Morse over here on Fox News saying, yeah, you know, send the American soldiers over there. You know, put bullseyes on their backs. We're discovering now also Monica Goodling is the person who was behind covering up the breasts of Lady Liberty in the Justice Department during the reign of John Ashcroft. That's an interesting little thing here. Wong Kett, Anna Marie Cox. Excerpts of Washington Post article where Mitt Romney makes this rather startling claim. He says, it seems that Europe leads Americans in this way of thinking. He was speaking to 5,000 people. He said, in France, for instance, I'm told that marriage is now frequently contracted in seven-year terms, where either party may move on when their term is up. How shallow and how different from the Europe of the past. This is Mitt Romney talking about France. Actually, no such thing in France. What Romney was quoting from, and apparently thought was true, was a book by Orson Scott Card, a libertarian who has been on this program, actually. The book is called The Memory of Earth, and it's a fictionalization of the Book of Mormon set in outer space. Go figure that one. It just gets stranger and stranger. Let's take a quick look at what's going on with the U.S., with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
These developments in Iraq as of 10:30 GMT from Reuters. Dateline Kufa, at least 16 people were killed and 70 wounded when a suicide car bomb exploded at a crowded market in the Shiite city of Kufa, 100 miles south of Baghdad. In Baghdad, police said they recovered 30 bullet-riddled bodies overnight, including 17 in the religiously mixed neighborhood of Amil. In Baghdad, at least 4 people were killed and 8 wounded by mortar round attacks in different districts of the town. Dateline Baghdad, the Iraqi army killed 7 insurgents and arrested 115. In Baghdad, U.S. forces detained 13 suspected insurgents. Gunmen killed in Iskenderia. Gunmen killed two people and wounded three others on Monday. And also in Iskenderia, two people were killed and 10 wounded by a mortar round attack in that city. Oh, and finally, apropos not of Iraq, but of me in this program, on May 17th, I'll be in Denver, KKZN. We're going to be doing the show live from the Boulder Theater, 9 a.m. to noon. You can get more information at am760.net. And on May 19th, I'll be broadcasting live from KTRC in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and also doing a presentation, a speech, and a book signing afterwards at 2 p.m. Doors open at 1:30 at the Greer Garson Theater. And you can get tickets by listening to KTRC, our Santa Fe affiliate. They will tell you how. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, or the number for our live, or the email address for, well, what do you call it? URL. You go to tomhartman.com, click on live chat, it'll get you there. That's the bottom line. Scott in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, listening on KLSD. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Yeah, and speaking of San Diego, you'll be here on Friday.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. And
counting down the moments. I'm a quivering mass of anticipation.
Yeah, right.
Which is a sight to behold.
We're gonna have fun. It's a Cosmopolitan restaurant, 4 o'clock Friday afternoon in San Diego's Old Town. So.
Yeah. Earlier you were talking about Alcoa, and then just now earlier this hour you were talking about journalism. I want to give you a brief history snippet about Alcoa and journalism. And back in the early 50s, like 1951, Alcoa was the main sponsor of Edward R. Murrow's program See It Now on CBS television. And part of their reason for their association with the program was they were under a cloud of legal action regarding this monopolistic practices that they were supposedly involved in. And
that was around the time of that Supreme Court decision, wasn't it,
that
Lauren Hand wrote about?
And they wanted to kind of clean up their image and be associated with Murrow, which worked out all right until he started doing some rather controversial programs on the topics on the program, and they finally canceled. They withdrew their sponsorship.
Interesting, Scott. And, thanks for the insight and the info there. Len in New York City. Hey, Len, what's up?
Hi, I was walking through Penn Station here in New York today, with the camouflaged outfit standing guard. And, right after I heard about the Fort Dix incident, and I walked over to a couple of guys and asked them if they heard about it. They said, yeah, and I said, I don't understand. I thought we were supposed to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them over here.
Right. Yeah,
and you know,
none of them know how to buy an airplane ticket, or this is so absurd. When you occupy somebody's country, they try to throw you out, and the people of Iraq do not want Al Qaeda in Iraq any more than we do. And if we leave, they will destroy Al Qaeda.
Well, what I wanted to also point out was, I'm an Orthodox Jew, so I've been following the events in Israel for pretty much most of my adulthood. And, this is how it started there. I mean, they started attacking soldiers as being, because they're the occupier. And all of these suicide bombers came after a while, when the level of frustration by the, by the occupation just kept growing and growing, that they would do anything that they could. But now there's one other request I wanted to make.
Mm-hmm.
And, I love the guests you have on, Bernie and everyone else, but, it's 8 months till the primaries. And if you look at what the right wing has been doing already, they're regularly rotating the guys who are running for office to get people familiar with them and to just be able to, in some instances, just throw them softballs, but also to let them voice their views.
No,
really,
that's the key thing, Len, is the throw them softballs part. And I don't do suck up interviews with politicians.
But
if they're not willing to come on the program and answer hard questions or take calls from listeners, then they don't get on. And there are a lot of you'd be amazed, Len, the conversations that we have with offices of politicians who say, I will talk about this and this, but not that, or you can't ask me about this and that kind of thing. I mean, it's just I don't do it. I'm just don't do it. Yes, we've got some good politicians, and yes, some of their messages need to get out there. And yes, probably some of them will be on the program as time goes on. But not with preconditions, and not with, here's the question. I mean, I literally have had people, high-level politicians, say, here are the questions I would like you to ask me on the air. And at that point, we say, thanks, but no thanks. You're not going to be a guest on the show. Craig in San Jose. Hey, Craig.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great.
You're great, but you're getting better, I know.
There you go.
I really appreciate your tagline about, democracy begins with us, and I wanted to suggest a call to action for your listeners. I totally agree with you also that one of the things we need in order to make government more accountable to voters instead of big campaign donors is public financing of campaigns.
Yeah.
And there's a bill before the California Assembly right now that really needs people's support. It's AB 583. And the key thing that I'd like to suggest is that people call Assembly Speaker Fabian Nunez and urge him to support AB 583. Could I give out his phone number?
Sure.
It's area code 916-319-2046. Again, area 916-319-2046.
Okay, great.
Hey, thanks
well
very
done.
Much.
Yep, thank you very much. Dave in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Let's see if I can tie the first hour of your show and the last one together here in a quick one. I was looking through the news today, and I see that Chevron, in the last 24-48 hours, is admitted to paying Saddam kickbacks during the oil for food program.
Yeah, and you see that those kickbacks, not just Chevron's share, but there was five companies involved, El Paso, Chevron, Texaco, Bay Oil, and Mobil. Those kickbacks were $1.8 billion, and Chevron is going to pay a $25 million fine.
Exactly.
And Condi Rice was on the board at the time this was happening.
That's the point. That was my point. Not, and I did a Google News search on this, not mentioned in any of the press. Only one progressive outlet has got this story. She was not only on the board, she led the public policy committee, which oversaw areas of potential political concerns for the company.
Yeah, what a surprise.
Tell me she didn't know.
No, it was she certainly did if she was doing her job, and if she wasn't doing her job, well, that's the same as with 9/11. You could say that she wasn't doing her job. 45, thank you, Glenn. 45 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
There you go. 9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Don in Peoria, Arizona. Hey, Don, what's up?
Oh, yeah, Tom, how you doing? Hey, Tom, listen, I wanted to ask you about, you were talking a little while ago. Can you hear me all right?
I can.
Yeah the line's kind of got bad.
Yeah, there's a buzz on it.
You were talking before about that you were not a member of the Democratic Party. I thought, what's the difference between, you know, there has to be an affiliation, right? What's the difference between being, like, you have to register to vote, right? And what's the difference between registering and being a member of a party?
Well, I
know you're not a Republican, so I'm for
no, I'm not a
Democrat.
You know, when I have always registered my entire life. I've always registered as an independent. And in some states, for example, here in Oregon, that prevents me from voting in the Democratic primary. which, yeah, there's a downside to that. And in fact, if a Democratic primary was really tight and I really cared passionately about it, I would re-register as a Democrat in order to be able to vote in that primary. Right. But that's pretty much it. I've done fundraisers for the Democratic Party in various counties in the state and in other places around the country. I support the Democratic Party. I also, however, support the Green Party. I think the Green Party is doing great work across the United States. Instant runoff voting, things like that. The Green Party, over 300 communities now have instant runoff voting as a result of efforts of the Green Party. So, in Vermont, the Progressive Party, Anthony Polina is a friend of mine. He ran for governor and Progressive got about a quarter of the vote. There's a lot of good people in politics. And so, and also because I do a talk show, the idea of a certain level of kind of institutional independence appeals to me. And I would say, for example, when I lived in Vermont in I think it was the 2000 election, I voted for Ralph Nader, it was a safe state, but I didn't make that mistake again in 2004. I voted for John Kerry. I also voted, while we lived in Vermont, I voted for a Republican. I voted for Jim Jeffords. And, I think time has demonstrated that that was a good vote. So I'm at the same time, I enthusiastically salute people who participate with individual political parties, show up every month at the meetings, join the parties, become part of the parties, and take over the parties. And I've been saying for a long time, I think that we progressives need to get inside the Democratic Party and take it over and be a part of it. I realize that there's a certain level of internal contradiction in some of that, but that's where I'm at and what I'm doing. Jeff in Grand Isle, Vermont. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Listen, I'm a postal worker, and I just want to let people know out there what's going on in the postal service. I'm a carrier. My union just refused a contract with the government. What's going on with the postal services? They're basically privatizing new routes that come up. I'll give you an example. So if like 2,000 people build a little suburb there, what's going to happen is that contract will be bidded out privately to the lowest.
Yeah, no, it happened just down the road from us in a community called Beaverton, just down the road from Portland, just very recently.
And also, a whole
lot of uproar about it. They pulled back and deprivatized it. But it's like, do you really want the guy who was the pizza delivery man last week delivering your Social Security check and your credit card statement and all your private information that could lead to identity theft this week? And most people don't. And we need to work to stop the Postal Service from any further privatization.
Yeah, sorry for interrupting, but they've already had quite a few cases where people have been picked up doing these things by this bid system.
Right. Yeah. With the Postal Service, when you actually have a postal employee, you have a professional who has a career at stake, who really cares about it, who has been through extensive training, who has put their life into it, who has made a commitment to it, who has a good pension, who has a good salary, and has a solid investment in a commitment to a career as in the Postal Service, and it really is. It's a good and honorable and important career, and it shouldn't be outsourced to the lowest bidder, and it shouldn't be made the equivalent of delivering a pizza, because delivering the mail is not the same thing as delivering a pizza. Paul in Lafayette, Louisiana. Hey, Paula.
Hi. I know y'all are talking about the insurgency and the news and all, and I just want to let you... Have you read Michael Reagan's the opinion on the candidate demonstrate cowardice.
Right. No, I don't read Michael Reagan. I don't have.
Okay, well, it's interesting because today, in the opinion I have, it refers to the Republican candidates are facing hostility that has from homegrown insurgency that has captured the Democrat Party, the mainstream media, and liberal Chris Matthews at NBC.
See, this is the tragedy. Paula, thanks for pointing that out. I mean, this is the tragedy of what happens on any side. When people are bereft of ideas, when they have nothing positive to say, nothing to advance, no agenda to advance, arguably, in the case of the Republican Party and some of these cons, the agenda that they're trying to advance, they want to conceal. They really don't want people talking about globalization. They don't want people talking about so-called free trade. They don't want people talking about the ongoing destruction of the middle class. So what do? They engage in name-calling. And it's just, all the more the tragedy. The Democrat Party, it's like, trying to, as Newt, suggested back 20 years ago, emphasize the rat, right? It's, come on. And then homegrown insurgency, it's tragic. Thank you, Paula, for confirming my good sense and not ever bothering to read that man's writings. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, I'll be confronting Chris Slattery and his statement that New York Governor Spitzer wants to enshrine abortion. In Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, Benjamin Barber is here on how markets corrupt children and vandalize adults and swallow citizens whole. And as always, the best of the rest of the news, that and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.